I'm a vice president of Partners for Progressive Israel. Partners welcomes you and hopes you'll consider joining us for future conference calls and webcasts, in addition to participating in other PPI events. Here I just want to mention very briefly our upcoming annual trip to Israel from June 14th to the 21st. Information on the trip can be found on our website, progressiveisrael.org. Before I introduce today's speaker, Hillel Schenker, just a few technical reminders. As I've mentioned, all of you are now muted. After our speaker's presentation and after a few questions that I, as moderator, will take the liberty of asking, those of you who wish to ask a question will need to press star 6 to unmute your phone. And after your question and the speaker's reply, just please remember to remute your phone again by pressing star 6. So today, Partners for Progressive Israel welcomes Hillel Schenker, who joins us from Tel Aviv. Hillel is a dear friend of BPI. He plays a leading role in fostering open dialogue between Israelis and Palestinians, even through the most difficult of times, and this is certainly one of those. Hillel does this best through co-editing, along with Ziad Abu Zayad, the Palestinian-Israel Journal, the region's only joint Israeli-Palestinian publication. Hillel has been co-editor since 2002, playing a leading role in co-overseeing this quarterly publication that presents perspectives from both sides of the conflict on critical issues facing the two peoples. Just some of Hillel's accomplishments earlier on. Hillel made Aliyah in 1963. He lived for 13 years on Kibbutz Barkai, and he served as editor of New Outlook, a monthly Tel Aviv-based journal in the spirit of Martin Buber's philosophy of dialogue. From 2008 to 16, Hillel served as vice chair and then chair of Democrats Abroad Israel. He also served for many years on Meretz Party Convention. And he is well equipped today to talk with us about last week's election within the Meretz Party and its implications for the future of the left in Israel and the future of Meretz in particular. Hillel, welcome, and thank you so much for being with us. The floor is yours.
Okay, thank you, Lenny. I'm very happy to be here from Tel Aviv, and I'd like to begin by just noting that this evening on Israeli TV, they have a program on seven people who have made a difference in the first 70 years of Israel, and the person who is being featured tonight is Shulamit Aloni, who was the founder and the first leader of Meretz back in 1992. And I mention that because I think it's important to look at the historical perspective to get to where we are today. Now, first of all, this Meretz leadership contest, which we just witnessed, really had Meretz prominently in the news. Interesting. It was dynamic. There was a lot of competitive spirit, and this, of course, makes news. So that helped Meretz gain greater prominence. When we look back at the history, Meretz was founded in 1992, a combination of three parties: Mapam, Ratz, and Shinui. And actually, the first three leaders of Meretz came from Labor, from the Labor Party. Shulamit Aloni originally left Labor when she got into a conflict with Golda Meir and founded Ratz. And then Yossi Sarid left Labor when he was disillusioned with their positions. And Yossi Berlin, the third leader, left Labor. The fourth leader was Chaim Oron, Jumis from Mapam. And Galon, Zahava Galon, the latest leader for the past 6 years, actually came from Gratz. Now, Tamar Zandberg, what is unique about her is that she is the first leader of Meretz who came from Meretz. She had not been in another party beforehand. She joined directly into Meretz. Now, the high point of Meretz was the first year, 1992, when it had 12 members of Knesset, four ministers, and was very influential in Yitzhak Rabin's government, which led, of course, to the Oslo Accords. The low point was when there were three members of Knesset in 2009. Now, in 2009, the leader of Meretz and the candidate was Chaim Oron, Jumas, who was very respected by everybody. He was considered an excellent candidate, but he had the misfortune of running at the same time as Tzipi Livni was the head of Alex Sharon's Tnua party. And she said, vote for me so I can defeat Netanyahu. I will then become prime minister and peace will be my priority. And when she did that, at least three seats from Meretz moved over to Tzipi Livni, and that's why it was the low point of only three members of Knesset. Unfortunately, even though Livni had one more seat in the Knesset than Netanyahu, she was a poor politician and she didn't form a government. Netanyahu ended up being the prime minister anyway. Here we are now today in 2018. If Amir Peretz had won the Labor Party leadership contest, we would have had the same scenario as we had with Tzipi Livni. Meretz would not have had the opportunity it has today because Amir Peretz would have been perceived as being someone who was on the left, definitely interested in social justice, very committed to peace, one of the founders of Peace Now, but he lost. And so instead, we have the leader of Labor is Avi Gabay, who presented himself as if he would be an Israeli Macron coming out of the blue, somebody young, relatively unknown. He's 51. He came from a Likud family and the centrist Kulanu, and his policy has been, I'm going to appeal to the right and let the left go to Meretz, and that's how we'll build the center-left bloc. Appealing to the right clearly has not worked so far, and the polls indicate that Labor would drop from its current 24 seats to 12 seats, but it definitely has helped Meretz. And this is one of the reasons why the Meretz primary was so energetic and it was so competitive. Now, Zahava Galon campaigned for the idea of open primaries. What she wanted is to have every Israeli who would register to vote for the Meretz leader could do so if they registered 2 weeks in advance of the elections. And I personally told her, I don't think that's fair or realistic. There should be at least a 6 months membership before you're allowed to vote. But that was her position. Now, Ilan Gilon, the other major candidate, veteran, who had been the chair of the Meretz Knesset faction, wanted the old voting system. The old voting system said only the 1,000 members of the Meretz Convention elected from all of the branches around the country would have the right to vote for the leader. Now, this was very problematic, and it was actually Tamar Zandberg who came forward with the compromise. She said, instead of allowing every Israeli to vote, let all Meretz members vote. And we have another month and a half to go. People can sign up, and everybody who is a member of Meretz, a dues-paying member, will have the right to vote. And that compromise was accepted, and the fact is that within that brief amount of time, Meretz's membership more than doubled from 15,000 to 31,000. And so this was clearly, a tremendous achievement. Now, as I said, the leadership contest aroused a tremendous amount of interest. And suddenly, first of all, there were the two veteran candidates, Zahava Galon, the leader for the past 6 years, who is 62, and Ilan Gilon, who is 61, and three younger candidates joined the competition. A member of Knesset, Tamar Zandberg, she's been a member for the past 5 years, who is 41. The former Peace Now executive director, Avi Buskila, who is a veteran IDF officer and also happens to be gay, is 42. And social activist, also relatively experienced merits member, Avi Dabosh, who is 41. And the last two are both Mizrahi, Eastern Jews, and they grew up also in right-wing families. So this made for a very interesting and stimulating a competition for leadership. On February 28th, barely a month before the actual elections, both Zahava Galon and Ilan Gilon dropped out of the race on the same day, which caught everybody by surprise. Apparently, Zahava felt, as she went out to meet with people in the course of campaigning, that her feeling of the pulse of the merits voters was that they wanted a newer, younger leader. And Ilan Gilon dropped out for health reasons. He has health problems, which are not totally clear, but he felt he couldn't continue with the he didn't have the stamina to continue with the campaign. A third candidate dropped out, Dabosh, Avi Dabosh, announced his support for Tamar Zandberg, and that left the race just between her and Avi Buskila. And although Avi has been a merits member for 12 years, he hadn't really been active in the party. He had been doing other things, and he had been the executive director of Peace Now for the past 2 years, more or less. Now, I was personally at the launch of Tamar Zandberg's campaign at Kuli Alma, which is a very, as the name sounds, cool place, a very trendy pub performance space in Tel Aviv. These days, politicians on all sides of the Israeli spectrum hold a lot of encounters with voters in pubs. The launch that she held, I felt, was highly professional. There were hundreds of young people there, and barely a handful of people who are my age. And I must say, it reminded me a lot of the energy that I felt and that I remembered from the Merits launch back in 1992. And even singer Donna Berger, who performed in 1992, also performed now, clearly one of the elements trying to recall the energy that was felt back in 92. Tamar herself began her political career as a parliamentary assistant to member of Knesset Ron Cohen, who also was a minister and was a senior officer who was considered very much a social activist. He passed one of the major achievements of merits over the years is passing a law for public housing. And it's known as a merits achievement and Ron Cohen achievement. And Ron spoke at this launch in favor of Tamar Zandberg, just as also Yossi Belen, who didn't speak there, but he also announced his support for her. Now, at the it was a very professional launch. A public relations expert, Nisim Duak, who has done a lot of public relations work for civil society organizations and for left-wing politicians, spoke and outlined the campaign. And, of course, Tamar herself spoke and spoke very well. The master of ceremony of the launch was Uri Zaki, who also is her live-in partner and serves as the president of the Merits Convention. And the two of them are very much considered a power couple. The voting was held last week, and as expected, Tamar Zandberg won overwhelmingly with 71% of the vote. Avi Buskila got 28% of the vote, which, all things considered, the fact that he's relatively unknown in the party is quite an achievement, and I have no doubt that he will be a member of Knesset in the next Knesset. And I would add that last Saturday there was a mass rally, 35,000 people in Rabin Square, against the deportation of the African refugees. And one of the Mizrahi speakers from South Tel Aviv said that things will change when Avi Buskila will become prime minister. So, you know, he is a symbol in a certain sense, and the fact that he will be working together as part of the leadership team, I think, is very important. Another element in the coming elections will be that we have, of course, Netanyahu being 68, 69, The other two leaders who are competing, it's Yair Lapid from Yesh Atid, who is considered the leading candidate from the center-left to replace Netanyahu, is 54. Avi Gabay is 51, and Zandberg is 41, which means that she's the next generation, and she speaks very much the language of the younger generation of Israelis and will be able to communicate with them quite well. Looking at her, she, as I said, sees former member of Knesset and Minister Ron Cohen as her mentor in politics. He was the one who really introduced her to the political world. And then she decided to take a step on her own when she joined the Tel Aviv Municipal Council, where she served for 5 years as a member on behalf of Meretz, and was also active in the 2011 social protest movement. When she became a Knesset member in 2013, she dropped out of her doctoral studies in politics and government at Ben-Gurion University to devote herself full-time to politics. She's a good speaker, and her basic stump speech is very impressive and presents a comprehensive worldview, emphasizing social justice, economic justice, environmental issues. She also, of course, gender and the struggle against the occupation. I was also at a campaign rally that she held in Tel Aviv at a cafe near Rabin Square, which is also near her home, and I saw that she handled all of the questions. There was a real variety of people from different walks of life who were there who challenged her. And she responded to each one very clearly, and I felt handled it very well. Her campaign slogan was Meretz Mitoreret. Meretz is waking up. And one of the primary things that she has been saying is that Meretz should aim to get 10 seats. It now has 5, and it should become a factor influencing the government, meaning that it should aim to be a part of government. And in a sense, her slogan echoed what Yossi Sarid's slogan back in 1992, which was Meretz Yamritz et Rabin. Meretz will energize Rabin, which is a play on words, a play on Meretz, Mamritz. And of course, Meretz had a key role in what became the Oslo Accords. Another thing that she constantly says is we should not apologize for anything. We should not be on the defensive. We should be proud of who we are. And her goal, she says, is that Meretz should energize Lapid Gabay to move leftward in all spheres of Israeli life. And now, taking pragmatism to the extreme, she made what it was perceived as a controversial statement that Meretz should be ready to sit in the government also with Lieberman from Yisrael Beitenu, Israel Our Home Party, the current defense minister, provided, of course, that they would accept a platform that Meretz could live with. Lieberman, although he lives in a settlement, has actually said he's in favor of a two-state solution, and he said that if necessary, he would move from his settlement Nokdim if that would be an obstacle to peace. So it's not totally inconceivable, but still, Lieberman is not exactly the cup of tea for most people in Meretz. Now, it seems to be working. In other words, the last major poll that was taken, were elections to be held, and there was a thought that there might be elections in June, although that apparently has passed. The latest poll said that Meretz would rise to 9 seats, which is very close to the 10 that she was aiming for. And there was a poll yesterday on the Knesset channel which suggested even the possibility of 11 and 12 seats. So something seems to be working here. Now, I think it's important also to note that during the last few days since being elected, she's faced her first major challenge due to the revelation that she received advice from a controversial PR specialist, Moshe Klughaft, who also advised Naftali Bennett and the Bayat Ayudi right-wing party and created campaigns against human rights NGOs. Haaretz has featured a number of articles which are very critical of her, and some writers even called on her to resign. Monday's editorial was titled "Zandberg on Probation," is saying Zandberg raised doubts about her judgment and her image as a principled politician. I disagree personally with those criticisms, and I was particularly impressed by an op-ed that was published today by Dr. Dmitry Shumsky. I don't know if he's someone who is familiar to you. He should become familiar. As you can tell from his name, he's Russian, and he's a researcher on political history of Zionism and modern Jewish nationalism at Hebrew U. He wrote an article today titled "The Treacherous Attack Against Zandberg." There was another article today also by Nachemia Stressler, the economics correspondent for Haaretz, who along the same lines, sharply criticizing, and I think justifiably, the attacks from the left against Zandberg, particularly in the Haaretz. He wrote that we should be proud that a fighting, fearless leader is at the head of the left camp today, who is not afraid to use the tools of a patriotic discourse used by the right. She has said, support for Israel means ending the occupation. There is no more patriotic act than opposing the occupation, than working for economic justice, than working for social justice. And what she is doing is clearly demonstrating that the right doesn't have a monopoly on patriotism. I suggest that I'll stop there, and let's take it from there.
Thank you very, very much, Hillel. This was most informative, and you hit many of the critical issues surrounding the election, the pre-election period, and what you foresee as some of the ramifications of the future given Tammy's election. I'll just take the liberty of asking the two questions first, and then I'll just want to say to those who are on the phone, please recall that after Hillel has responded to the two questions that I'm posing, you can unmute yourself by pressing star 6 and asking your question, and then remembering to re-mute yourself afterwards. So I'll just take the liberty of asking you, Hillel, where do you see Meretz in terms of a possible new left alliance with Labor, possibly with Yesh Atid, with Lapid's party? And I ask that especially in light of the invective that Labor has, especially Gabay, has hurled against Tammy, with regard to the current crisis with the Klukoks.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'm sure the current crisis will pass over very quickly and we'll move on to other dramas. That's the nature of Israeli life, that we have serial dramas. And matter of fact, one of the interesting things is that Tamar, or Tammy Zandberg, was featured as a character in the two major satirical programs on Israeli TV over the weekend. Programs like the ones that are featured now in the States Against Trump. And the fact that she was a character there as a result of all of the prominence of what's been happening means that everybody in Israel now knows that there is a Tamar Zandberg. Before that, it was mainly us, the people on the left and the people who are involved in Meretz. The outcome of the elections will depend, of course, to a great degree on what happens with all of the investigations with Netanyahu. He really wanted elections now. Matter of fact, there were three factors who wanted elections to take place in June. They were Netanyahu and the Likud, Yesh Atid, Yair Lapid, and Meretz, because the way Meretz is doing in the polls, Meretz also wanted elections now. Everybody else was afraid of elections. In other words, the other right-wing parties were afraid that Netanyahu would cause them maybe even to be out of the Knesset by insisting that everybody should vote for him. Labor, obviously, is on the ropes right now with only 12 seats, and so they definitely didn't want elections either. I think the way I see it is that there is a reasonable possibility that a center-left government could be elected in the next elections. It will depend to a great degree on what will happen with the investigations with Netanyahu. There is clearly no obvious successor to him who has anywhere near the level of charisma and support from the right-wing base that he has. And so therefore, the prospect of a center-left government is something that one can take seriously. And as things stand now, the leader would be Lapid, not Gabay, because as I described before, so far Gabay has not taken off. And clearly, in such a configuration, Meretz would be a significant component within a center-left coalition.
Thanks, Hillel. And one more question. There needs to be some healing, I would assume, within Meretz because of some of these struggles, some reaching even to what I might call trauma, prior on the issue of open primaries. And I know also that there's some difficulty with Ilan Gilon's group of very young people called the Red Camp, who are given over to very strong socialist principles. How do you see the healing taking place?
Okay, I think one of the elements is time. A second element, first of all, Ilan Gilon expressed his support for Tamar Zandberg. So he will definitely try to convince and hopefully also be a member of the next Knesset as well. And a lot will depend on how Tamar handles all of the tests that she is now facing, the test of the questioning about the fact that she availed herself for free and at his initiative of this controversial PR specialist, and also the ability to unite all of the factions of the party. There are a number of Meretz Facebook pages, and the former deputy mayor of Tel Aviv, Michael Re'eh, made what I think is a very simple and good suggestion. Everybody should relax. Everybody should take it easy, not write anything for a week, digest what has happened, and then let us move on to building and working. And there is a tremendous amount of potential here. Tamar has There are a lot of new young members of Meretz today, and I think that if we all join hands, that it will be possible to overcome the current difficulties.
Thanks again, Hillel. Okay, we're going to open this up now to everyone on the phone. Please remember, you can unmute yourself by pressing *6, and then please remember to remute yourself after your question has been addressed. Okay, so the floor is open.
Hello?
Yes, please, go ahead.
What are the possibilities?
Tell us your name.
This is Bob Tabak. Bob Tabak in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. What are the possibilities for Meretz and maybe the left in general to move out of a kind of what's perceived as kind of an Ashkenazi, well-educated enclave to a wider social base of people that would be interested in it, that could speak to a much wider working class and other kind of groups of people. Thanks.
Yeah. Okay. Well, first of all, the fact that two of the leading candidates in Meretz were Mizrachim, who came from the periphery, Abi Buskila and Avi Dabush, and they will be part of the leadership, clearly. I assume that they will also both be members of Knesset, is a signal. And the fact is that Tamar has also said that there should be a national policy of reaching out throughout the country and not just staying within the comfort zone of the greater Tel Aviv area and the kibbutzim, et cetera. Looking at labor, the fact is that Avi Gabay is also Mizrahi of Moroccan background. As a matter of fact, the two leading candidates who competed over the leadership were Avi Gabay and Amir Peretz, who both come from a Moroccan background. Now, it's not only having to reach out to the Mizrahim, it's also reaching out to the Russians, reaching out to the Palestinian Israelis, the Israeli Arabs, 20% of the population, and reaching out to some degree to the moderate religious and being ready to find formulas to work together with the ultra-Orthodox Haredim, who have their own interests but are not against, per se, social justice or peace. So it's really a question of developing a... I remember that in the States, I forget the name of the chair of the Democratic Party who was from Maine, I think, who wanted a 50 states policy. And essentially, we have to translate that into an Israeli reality of reaching out to all sectors of Israeli society and not only to the so-called comfort zone.
Again, question. Go ahead, please.
Yes, my name is Odile Lugono-Heber, and in 2013, I went to Haifa for a conference on if Israel doesn't come to Helsinki, Helsinki will come to Israel. It was about a weapon of mass destruction-free zone in the Middle East. Does anyone still speak about it?
Unfortunately, right now, matter of fact, I sent you a message on Facebook today when you asked this question, but I will answer it here as well. Right now, unfortunately, that is not a major issue on the agenda because what everyone is thinking about at the moment is will the agreement with Iran continue, and if it doesn't continue, what will be the repercussions if Trump withdraws? The Saudis have already said if the Iranians will work on their nuclear program, then we will too. There's a genuine danger of nuclear proliferation in the region. And this is not the central issue on the Meretz agenda right now. This is something that really has to be developed in the regional sphere and the international sphere. Unfortunately, right now, it's very difficult to do that. And as I said, the focus at the moment is to hopefully save the deal with the Iranians and then to move on from there.
Thank you.
Others, please remember to press star 6.
Hello. It's a Paul Sham in Washington. I wanted to know if you thought there was any chance, and if so, how, to for mayors to attract the middle-class voters who are voting for Lapid and Kulano. Do we have anything that may attract them? Thanks.
Yeah. I think that may be more difficult. It's, you know, Lapid is actually reaching out to the right, Kahlon also. And now the question is really, will the Meretz leadership with Tamar, will they be able to formulate clear proposals which will be attractive to the middle class? For example, one of the things that Tamar has been leading the fight for is the issue of public transportation on Saturdays. This is a major problem for many people in the country, and there's clearly a majority support for public transportation on Saturdays. There is also a majority support for the right to have open groceries and supermarkets on Saturdays. Now, at the campaign rally that I was at that Tamar gave, there was actually the leader of the head of the Small Shopholders Association was there and asked a question about that issue. And Tamar clearly said this is one of the things that we will be fighting for. And so if there will be a perception that Meretz will be a significant factor in a promoting issues which are of concern to the middle class in general around the country, then this might also help attract people who would be tending to vote for Kulano or Lapid, Yesh Atid.
Thanks.
Yeah.
It's Karen Shapiro from Los Angeles. Given that there a two-part question. First part is, what do you think Tamar's biggest focus is going to be moving forward now that this is over and given there's not upcoming elections in June? And when do you think the next elections, I mean, I'm sure it could be any time, but do you have any ideas of when that might be?
Okay, there are estimations that the elections might be held in October, they might be held in January. It will depend a lot on the timetable of all of these investigations of Netanyahu and when the various parties will feel, because it's Netanyahu essentially who can call an election. And if he will feel that it is in his interest, then he will call it. So we don't know, but there is an assumption that it will not last out until the end of the term, which is November 2019. Now, I think that what Tamar will have to do now, and I believe I understand that what she intends to do, is to develop an overall strategy which will present a comprehensive worldview on all of the major issues on the Israeli agenda, and to then present that to the public in a very strong, firm manner, because she is seen as someone who is not afraid to be forceful and to be proud of the positions that she and Meretz are taking. And I think that's the next step. The next step is really to consolidate the leadership. There will be, of course, a point where there has to be an elections for the new Knesset list. And there are a number of young people, some of whom said, you know, were running already, like Avi Buskila and Avi Dabosh, and there are others who will undoubtedly be a part of the list. I do hope that Ilan Gilon will continue as well, and I don't know, no one yet knows what Zahava's plans are. But this will not be just this. Someone said, matter of fact, there was a discussion on the Knesset channel recently in which they said Meretz is perceived not just as a leader. Other parties, sometimes it's the leader that everybody thinks about. But with Meretz, it's the leader and the actual group together and what they are fighting for. So I think that that's what Tamar is going to be doing. This is what I understand in the near future, developing a comprehensive strategy that then can be presented via the media and throughout the country, as I said, reaching out to all sectors of society.
Thank you.
Yeah, okay.
Other questions?
Hello. Can I go ahead?
Yeah, please.
Yeah, who are you?
Thank you. My name is Brent Blyer. I live in Syracuse, New York, and I met Hillel many years ago when he was touring cities of the U.S. to talk about the peace prospects before Oslo.
1984, and the peace and justice tour of people from around the world who were working for nonviolent conflict resolution.
Very good, very good. I'm
right.
Glad you remember. Anyway, we kept you very occupied while you were here, and I think you provided a lot of in-depth information to many different groups in our community and elsewhere. So my question is that here in the U.S. diaspora, at least, the progressive and leftist movements are very much focusing groups that are endorsing BDS, and we are well aware that in Israel, understandably, no one likes to have other people boycotting them, but also the issues that the government has penalized anyone who supports it. So I realize you can't really, perhaps, I don't know if you can do it in the conference call, address that in some way, but there is the historical knowledge that boycotts are successful, both domestically and internationally, as many of us are aware. And we're wondering sometimes, you can't maybe acknowledge that, is there some way we could work a little more closely, perhaps? I mean, we do through Peace Now and Breaking the Silence, other group, but which are also under attack at times internally in Israel. Is there a way that we could be better connected in some way in support of the Israeli progressive forces, which are, from this side, seem to be more and more struggling, though that may be changing with your new party head and your new emphasis?
No. By the way, ironically, that Peace and Justice Tour in 1984 was sponsored, among others, by the American Friends Service Committee, which is one of the organizations which today the right-wing Israeli government says shouldn't be allowed to come to Israel. Yeah.
Correct.
Despite the fact that they won a Nobel Peace Prize for helping Holocaust-era Jews, survivors of the Nazi Holocaust. Now, first of all, I would say that most of us in the Israeli peace movement, and this is also true of Meretz, we would support a boycott of anything to do with the settlements, and think that that is, just as Tamar has said, to be an Israeli patriot is to oppose the occupation. To be an Israeli patriot is to oppose the settlements and to boycott the settlements. That isn't the same as boycotting Israel as a whole. Obviously, if I'm working with the Palestine Israel Journal, that means I'm and my Palestinian colleagues are in favor of engagement. And here I will say that my Palestinian co-editor colleague, Ziad Abu Ziad, says that from his point of view, it's absurd for Palestinians not to work together with their allies within Israel, who are working for the same thing, an end to the occupation and the establishment of a Palestinian state alongside the state of Israel for the sake of Israel. In other words, it's clear that the Meretz position in general is that it is in Israel's interest to end the occupation. Now, a general BDS is problematic because it sends a very problematic message to the general Israeli public, suggesting that a lack of acceptance of their right to exist, whether this is said clearly or not, but this is the perception. Now, another element that I would add is that BDS is not working. It's not having a significant impact on the average Israeli. The average Israeli does not feel any sense of pain, and I do not believe that a BDS strategy can possibly succeed in changing the reality, the Israeli-Palestinian reality. Unlike the situation in South Africa, I do not see any government being ready to back a BDS policy, whereas there was governmental support for boycotting of South Africa. And even in South Africa, that many specialists will say that was not the key factor which led to the downfall of apartheid. There were other factors, primarily the fact that the Afrikaners were a small minority of, less than 10% of the population. They could not, it was unsustainable to continue to run an apartheid regime. And we had a meeting at the Palestine Israel Journal with one of the veteran South African freedom fighters who told us that the two primary reasons why apartheid ended were, one, the fact that what I just said, that it was unsustainable in long-range terms. And the second factor, which none of us really were aware of, was corruption. The Afrikaner government was extremely corrupt, and even the major businessmen were beginning to say, this isn't working. Now, we definitely have the element of corruption in Israel right now with Netanyahu. And so hopefully, you know, that can contribute to something. In terms of what can you do there with us here, we have to work together. We in Israel, you in the diaspora, we have something called the Israeli Peace NGO Forum, which was founded by Dr. Ran Pundak, one of the initiators of the whole Oslo process. And we had a meeting 2 weeks ago with two Israeli journalists asking them for their impressions, analysis, and recommendations. And they were Mazal Mu'alem, who writes for Al-Monitor, and Barak Ravid, who for many years was the political correspondent of Haaretz and is now on Channel 10. And Barak Ravid said at the end, what's my recommendation? My recommendation is that 50,000 liberal American Jews should come on Aliyah to Israel, and that would change the entire political landscape of Israel. Now, I'm afraid that that's not realistic, even though we do have some people who have come and who have joined us. But definitely, we should be working together, and I hope we are.
Right. Well, thank you. The group I was thinking of was Jewish Voice for Peace, which I believe is the largest or the fastest growing Jewish progressive group, though it's attacked by the mainstream Jewish community here quite openly and quite frequently.
The Israeli government is using BDS as, Netanyahu in general, his whole political career has been based on fanning the flames of fear of Iran,
right.
Fear
right.
of Hezbollah, of Hamas, of whatever. Now it's fear of BDS. BDS is the boogeyman, and it's the danger, even though, as I said, and you can see, all of the economic analysts say it's not having any impact. And this is, I wrote an article once, which you can look up at the Palestine Israel Journal, of what's wrong with BDS, which is primarily, I don't think that BDS can succeed. It can't achieve its goals. If it could, if BDS could force Israel to end the occupation and enable a Palestinian state to be established alongside the state of Israel, I would support it. But I don't think it's possible. It will not have that impact, and therefore we have to look for other tactics. And BDS may make some people feel good because they feel they're doing something, but it's not changing the reality.
We have to move on.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. We have time for one more question. Does anyone else have a question? If not, Hillel, let me pose this to you. There's been some sense of struggle among those of us in the States, especially those of us working in Partners for Progressive Israel, dealing with what takes priority. Is it the occupation? Is it the social or economic and anti-democratic issues going on here? And I've always thought of this as a false dichotomy. Can you talk a little bit about that tension between those two goals and how you see Meretz in the future addressing it?
Well, first of all, I don't see any contradiction between working for an end to the occupation, for social justice, and for preservation of democracy. They're all interconnected, and they all affect each other. So I very much hope that, of course, each one of us perhaps focuses on a particular element. At the Palestine Israel Journal, obviously, I'm focusing primarily on the issue of the Israeli-Palestinian relationship and the occupation. But Meretz, as a political party, should be, as I said before, having a comprehensive, integrated view of these issues because they are connected. And the fact is you can't have greater social justice if we don't end the occupation. If we don't end the pouring of all of these subsidies into the West Bank, to the settlements, instead of into education and social services what's called the peripheral towns and cities of the country, they're all connected. And the longer the occupation continues and the longer we have a right-wing government, the more democracy will be eroded. And they don't understand democracy to be the rights of the majority and the minority. They think that majority decides everything, and there's no room for minority, and there's no room for checks and balances. We see that process in the United States. We see that process in Israel. We see a worldwide phenomenon, and all of us have to fight back to preserve democracy, to ensure social justice, and to achieve peace in our various contexts. And I think that that's what Meretz is doing and will be doing, and that's what we should be all be doing together.
Hillel, you are really a ray of hope for the future. Thank you so much for this highly articulate...
Can I just make one other comment? One comment. You know, some people say to me exactly what you just said. You know, you are hopeful, you are a ray of hope. And what I say is that I feel that I can be hopeful because I feel that I'm in the front lines of confronting the challenges of the problems. And the degree to which all of us will be, you know, taking a role, playing a role in confronting the issues that concern us, I think that leads to knowledge and action leads to greater hope as well.
Yeah, very well said. PPI, on behalf of PPI, thank you very much, Hillel. And for those of you on the phone, thank you for your questions. Thank you for tuning in to this conversation. There will be many more. Please check on our website and tune into our emails, and Partners for Progressive Israel hopes to have your participation in the future. Again, thank you, Hillel, and bye-bye,
okay.
Everyone. Bye-bye.
Thank you all, and bye.